It's Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, what happens when local news isn't local? Our guest makes the case against the consolidation of smaller market media by national conglomerates.
First, Governor Scott Walker declared November 16th Rural Health Day. It's a chance to look at the challenges of rural health and to look at how healthcare providers are working with rural communities.
One in four Wisconsinites live in a rural community, and over half of Wisconsin counties are considered rural. Experts say these communities have unique healthcare challenges like hospital closures, lack of healthcare providers, and an aging population.
John Ike is the director of the State Office of Rural Health. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So we have this day now set aside for Rural Health Day. It's an awareness to, you know, bring more to rural communities. What makes rural populations different from other communities in the state?
Great question. And I wanted to point out, too, that this is actually National Rural Health Day. So Wisconsin joins with the other 49 states in celebrating this, all in different ways. So it's exciting to see it ripple across the country and ripple around our state as well. So the question was what makes rural different? As far as healthcare goes, you know, I think distance is one of the key. We have many different demographics and areas of the state, from central city Milwaukee through suburbs and then out to rural and more remote areas. They all have struggles. They all have strengths. I think one of the things you can really point to in rural, two things. One, folks tend to do a lot with a little bit, sort of that MacGyver attitude of taking the fewer resources that you have and spreading them thinner. A lot of times people wear 10 different hats to get all the work done in a small town. The other is transportation. You know, if you're trying to get to healthcare because something happened, a trauma, or you've got an illness, the specialists are further away. They tend to be in urban areas. The healthcare that you do have in the rural area, it's still often quite a drive. EMS struggles with this. By the time emergency medical services, that is, by the time, you know, when you call 911, by the time somebody gets out to you and then gets you back to a hospital or ER, time has passed. So that's a particular struggle. And as you pointed out, provider shortages are always something. We have a number of doctors here in Madison, but not quite so many in more of the remote areas.
Sure. And I actually would love to get a little bit more into that. When we had you on in March, I believe, and we talked about some state legislation that was being put forth to, you know, bring better access to health care in rural areas. And one of their big concerns was the fact that there aren't necessarily a ton of doctors, specifically specialists in these areas. You know, do we have anything moving forward to bring doctors into these areas?
There are several initiatives that are existing that I think work well. We have loan repayment programs. In other words, when a provider works, a primary care provider, so this would not be a specialist, but when they work in an underserved area, and that's both urban, again, sort of central city, or rural, when they work in these underserved areas, the program helps pay back some of their educational loans. So that works. We have very competitive wages that we can offer. I think it really comes down to, in the end, though, who identifies, who resonates with living in rural. Let's just take physicians. The physicians that work best in rural are often those that came from rural areas. And so a lot of these programs that serve as pipelines, getting kids interested in medical professions in their middle schools, in their high schools, so that they think, yeah, I'm going to go down to the UW in Madison and study medicine so that I can come back to my town and practice medicine. I think that works best. So there are several of those programs, both at the medical college and here at the UW, and they're important, the work that they do.
So in these rural areas, we were talking a little bit about the challenges, and one of those is that there is an aging population in much of these communities. What specific challenges does that pose, both for the people living there and for people providing care?
Well, as any of you know, again, I think it gets down to transportation is kind of a key issue. If you have relatives that are getting older, you know that one of the things you worry about is how they're getting around to go shopping or to get to doctor's appointments. Older populations tend to have more interactions with medical care, and so this comes up more often. And so they might tend to not make that doctor's appointment if it's too much of a drive, or they're just not feeling up to it. If they need it in the first place, maybe they're not feeling that healthy. So transportation is definitely an issue. We are actually working with, we just put out a request for proposal along with the nursing school for communities, rural communities that are working with on senior needs. And it's been so exciting to talk to these rural communities and hear about the ways that they're bringing everybody from the police chief and the library director to healthcare to work on the needs of their seniors, everything from staying healthy and vibrant and independent in their home to what their needs are if they have something like memory issues, dementia, or need to transition to an institution. People in rural areas want to keep their family members and their friends close, and so they're putting what they have together to figure out how to make this work for their community.
So that brings me to my next question is, why is this collaboration so important in rural areas?
I think it gets back to the, you know, doing more with less. There are fewer people in small towns to do this, you know, a lot of the same work, and so people have to multitask and they have to do take on more roles than they might otherwise be able to specialize in an urban area where there's higher populations. So you do more with fewer people. You do more with often less money, and you know, the hospital and healthcare, it's not as large as one of the big urban centers. So again, they're creating the best and some very high care, high quality care, with just these fewer resources. So it's that we can make this happen. I mean, you know, historically we think about farming as a rural thing, and it's not just farming, it's small towns, but farmers are used to doing this for generations. You know, you grab what you have at hand and you make it work to get that tractor out into the field today, because that's what you need to do. And that's what they do. That's an approach to life in general. And so again, they take extremely competent staff that come from all parts of the country, local and outside of the state, and they work magic with fewer resources.
We're talking to John Eich right now. He is the director of the State Office of Rural Health, and today, November 16th, is National Rural Health Day. Wisconsin just codified the same day to bring awareness to needs in rural communities. And part of what your office does is also talk about awareness around the community as a whole. And one of the things that comes out of your office is that you say rural does not mean remote. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so rural is one of those weird definitions that people have. It's kind of lodged in our psyche. Most people drive to a place and they look around and they say, yeah, this is rural. But I think there's a difference between a place that, like where I grew up, is about 30 minutes outside of Madison, and my closest neighbor was a mile away. But we were 30 minutes away from Madison, versus you get up into the northern parts of the state, they might be a small town of 2,000 people. You might have a neighbor 100 feet away, but you are much more distant to something like, you know, say a Home Depot or other resources, specialty care, et cetera. So there's a difference between density and remoteness, and all of that plays into what we talk about when we talk about rural and kind of the unique needs of each area.
And we've been talking a little bit about the challenges that face rural Wisconsin, not even just with medicine, but with lack of access, namely to broadband internet, bringing more people into the area to help repopulate it. You know, how do you see the rural areas of the state moving forward into the next decade or so?
I think rural areas are really, in my experience, kind of pools of innovation. They're doing some really amazing, interesting things, and the benefits of doing a project in a small town or a rural area is that you have a readiness to innovate, you have fewer obstacles in the way, and so people get very creative, and they do some really interesting things. They also have a lot of community will. People pull together for each other. You know, when it goes around that so-and-so had an accident on the highway, people come together, and there's a sense of cohesiveness there that you don't always get in a more metro area. So there's a lot of factors that are working in their favor, and they're doing some really interesting things that I think urban areas can learn from and look to as pilot areas and test sites for things.
John, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure, and happy Rural Health Day.
Thank you so much. John Eich is the director of the State Office of Rural Health, and he joined us to talk about rural health care in Wisconsin.
Right now, buy local. We hear that phrase all the time, often as a badge of honor, signaling a sense of pride in using our consumer dollars to support local businesses. Our next guest says we can think of local media in the same way.
For years now, local print and broadcast outlets have been bought up by large media conglomerates that often own dozens, if not hundreds, of media affiliates around the country.
Nick Meyer is the publisher at Volume One. You can find his article on this topic on the Central Time Facebook page. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, this is a nationwide story, Nick, but you focus in on the Chippewa Valley, the Eau Claire area. What is the current media landscape like there?
Sure. Well, it's healthy. I mean, there's certainly a number of quality radio stations, TV stations, newspapers throughout the Chippewa Valley area here. But suddenly this summer, I mean, upon this finally the sale of our independent daily paper for 135 years, the Leader Telegram, which is in a very important part of this community, was sold to one of those conglomerates, and is kind of going through the changes that you see when that happens. And so all of a sudden we found ourselves here at Volume One, which we've been doing our thing for about 15 years, that now we are the largest independently owned group in town, and it's just kind of it's unsettling to me because we're an interesting alt-weekly paper that covers the culture and happenings and the economic development things of our community, but all of our major news outlets that people are by and large consuming their local news out of are owned from afar now, and it's just kind of it was a piece that explored what does that mean? Does it matter? Does it not?
And this has been going on for a while, but now two FCC decisions, one of them today, may make it happen more. The FCC loosened a regulation that said if you have a TV or radio outlet, you actually have to have some kind of office presence in the market. And then the new one loosened restrictions on owning a TV station and a newspaper in the same market. So if anything, this is going to happen more, not less, in the future.
Yeah, and luckily, I mean, in our case here, you know, these stations, TV stations, radio stations, and the newspaper, of course, do have very robust presences in this community. They have, you know, they do have people that live and work here and report here, and sales staff, you know, that work from here and know the community really well. So that we do have a strong, you know, presence of reporters in the area. But as this grows and changes, you can never tell what direction that's going to go, what it's going to mean for coverage. But also what I'm interested in is, as you mentioned, the buy local aspect, where you know we think about how we spend our money in terms of buying from a big box retailer or a national chain restaurant or a local restaurant, but it's the same thing with media as well in a business to business sense. You know, some businesses choose to only spend their promotional dollars and things with Facebook or Google, which is, you know, probably the ultimate sin from all of us local media and even slightly less local media outlets. But that has an effect as well. I mean, where something is owned and where the dollars go tells a story, and how they may or may not reinvest that back into their communities. And again, though, thankfully, if these organizations have a strong presence in their community and they give that community and the management here in town the ability to make good decisions on behalf of their community, it's possible that none of it matters, and they can really do a great job of supporting their community, even though they are maybe owned out of Dallas or New York City or wherever else.
If I live in a community, what difference does it make to me if the newspaper, if I'm looking at a physical newspaper or their web presence, is owned locally, has a local presence, versus it has the local name on it, it happens to be owned and operated from far away?
Sure. Well, two things, I think. There is, first of all, the quality of the reporting and of the stories that you see. And that can go two directions when a company is bought by a larger conglomerate. There might be some of those that are hyper-focused on the local thing. They'll leave the national news to the major urban centers and to those, you know, New York Times papers and other esteemed sources. But they realize, hey, we have to be very, very, very local. And so it might even get better. They might invest in it. But at the same time, some of them you've seen, and there are studies on this sometimes, where a community might see larger corporate ownership take over, and suddenly you're seeing a lot more wire stories, and you're seeing stories that are the same across channels all over the country, and there's less local stories being told. So it can go either way. It can go well or it can go poorly. I think, thankfully, in our community, it's still going well. We have local reporters and the resources to tell those stories here, but I think there are probably other communities of similar size to Eau Claire elsewhere in the country that don't fare as well. But the other piece is that, you know, being aware of you know, where the money that they raise through advertising and stuff, where that goes and where does that get funneled to. If it gets sent off to Atlanta or wherever, the owners are, you know, much less likely to invest in those communities and start other businesses in those communities, whereas if something is locally owned, it might spin off and they might, you know, open an additional media outlet or invest in another project entirely or be much more philanthropic with their dollars in that community. So there's a couple different ways that it can impact people, I believe.
We're talking to Nick Meyer from Volume One. He wrote a recent piece on media consolidation and local media. Nick, let's talk about local coverage. I think a lot of times the splashy stuff is the presidential election, the big news in national politics. Can you talk about the importance of local coverage?
Well, certainly. I mean, and that's an area that, you know, that our publication doesn't get too involved in the political coverage and things. We're kind of here just to tell the positive stories of our community and the development and the cultural happenings and all of those types of things. But as a community evolves, like the ownership and the media voices evolve, you really want, you know, high attention on your local races from these local organizations. Those are the only places that are able to tell those stories. You're not going to get those from CNN or you know, the New York Times and things. So it's really important that they have those newsrooms and they ask those questions of their city council races and their school board races and things like that. Yeah, I mean, the presidential stuff tends to get the most eyeballs, but you know, if we're ever going to have success on a local level and build the communities that we all want to see, we need good, strong, you know, locally rooted media organizations to tell those stories. And that can be done if they're owned locally, and it can be done if they're owned from afar.
Well, and setting politics aside too, when we're talking about cultural coverage or local events, even if they're, you know, not politics, not the city council meeting, how important is that for a community and for a sense of community?
Oh, we think it's enormously important. I mean, the shift that Eau Claire has seen in recent years, I think, is due in part to the community awakening to itself and the amazing developments that are happening here in terms of cultural and the arts and the outdoors and music and everything that happens in the Eau Claire community. And that's because I think our local media community has done a much better job of reflecting the mirror on those parts of our community back to ourselves so we can get more excited about those things. And it just builds an enormous sense of pride to have those things. I mean, and that's another thing about media in general is, you know, a lot of times there's not a lot of time, there's not a lot of space necessarily, and it's easy to tell those stories about the news or the house fires and the car crashes and things like that, and those are important things to know about. But when you have locally owned media who really lives and breathes and cares about this place, they're more likely to dig in a little bit deeper and find those stories that make us proud of where we are, that make us inspired by each other and be able to go on and create inspiring things ourselves.
Now, you're a local weekly there, and that's a genre of media that's had a lot of hard times lately. A lot of major outlets in big cities, medium-sized markets around the country have closed or cut back substantially. How have you kept going with that model there?
Sure, no, it's true. Those headlines have been coming across. I mean, it just took a little while, I think, for the alt weekly world to catch up to what had been happening with daily newspapers for a while. I mean, there's still the interest in, you know, print versus digital, and then where are things going? And the places that are doing the best are the ones that are migrating to all the platforms in a stronger, better way through mobile and rich online experiences and video and things of that nature. But I think, I mean, our model is so unusual in that we're very ingrained in the community. We produce a number of different community events. We have a very large retail store and kind of cultural center in the lower level of our office. And we're just involved in the community in so many more ways other than just standing back from afar and covering it and commenting on it that we've fared very well, and we've only continued to grow. And we just actually did a whole round of hiring of 4 new additional positions as we continue to chart the course forward for what the ambitious things that we want to do for the community and the stories that we want to tell. And the community has always been very supportive back of us in that way.
We hear a lot about a decline in trust for the media. Do you think having more locally based reporters, as opposed to getting the sense that you're reading everything from the coast, whether it's politics or entertainment journalism or what have you, having that reporter being the person who you just saw last night at the concert?
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, developing of voices is something that, you know, local media has a better chance of doing than anybody, because they do live and work among you. They can speak your language. They know the inside jokes of the community, and they know, you know, the sore spots and things. And so if you're getting, you know, only wire stories from across the community, it's probably much more likely that you look at them with a skeptical eye. But yeah, exactly. When you live and breathe and you're part of that community and you develop that voice, which is something that we at Volume One have focused really hard on, to not be a media entity speaking down to the community, but to be next to the people of this community. We are one of you. We're talking about the same things. We're interested in the same things, and we have the same questions that you do. And the better you can do at developing that voice, I think the more trust you build between your community, and the more that they trust the ownership and the group overall to do right by the community that they live and work in.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Nick, we've been talking about the Eau Claire market where you are. Do you see similar scenes around Wisconsin?
In terms of the corporate ownership changing? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not sure what's even left of the major cities in the state. I think they had all sold off their daily papers, I think, for the most part, well before Leader Telegram did here in Eau Claire, and they hung on for quite a while, and they deserve some credit for that. But it's a trend that's going to continue to march on, and I think the public has to make peace with what that means and hold these, whether they're locally owned or they're owned from afar, hold these groups accountable to still do a good job, tell those stories, develop those voices, and help build the community in whatever way they can. And thankfully in Eau Claire, that is happening across all of our media outlets.
Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's Nick Meyer, publisher at Volume One in Eau Claire. We've been talking about the trend of large-scale media consolidation and its effect on local media coverage. You can find his article on the topic on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The internet has made it pretty clear that cats are its favorite animal. There's a treasure trove of online videos of cats running, hunting, catching, eating, sleeping, and more. And even though they're one of the most commonly owned and observed pets, cat behaviors still are often a mystery.
Our next guest says we can get along better with our cats by understanding their evolution and their nature. He's a cat behavior expert and the host of the Animal Planet show My Cat from Hell and a new show called Cat vs. Dog.
Jackson Galaxy is with us now. He's here to talk about his new book, Total Cat Mojo, The Ultimate Guide to Life with Your Cat. Jackson, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, when it comes to cats, Jackson, what is mojo?
Well, it's the same as when it comes to humans. It's sort of this inner confidence, this thing that just sort of bubbles up from inside of us and makes it so that we don't have to posture, we don't have to, you know, bow up and show everybody how tough we are, how cool we are. It's just sort of a natural state of you know, knowledge that you're home, you're at home with yourself. And I think that all cats have that equal source of mojo, and that's, you know, contact with their ancestor, the one that I call the raw cat. And if they can tap into that cat, then they're going to be a lot more, you know, mojo-fied.
And you use the phrase raw cat. Can you delve a little deeper into what you mean by that?
Well, the raw cat, what I mean by that is that there is a very straight line in an evolutionary sense between the cat that sits in your lap and the cat roaming the Fertile Crescent tens of thousands of years ago. Behaviorally, physically, they're very much the same. We haven't monkeyed with them in the way that we have done with dogs. We haven't asked them to do anything and then bred those characteristics into them. We left them alone to do their job, and their job was to hunt and catch and kill. And that was it. Keep our food supply safe. And then they just went along for the ride for those tens of thousands of years. It really wasn't until the last maybe 120, 130 years that we've brought them into our houses and then immediately started making dog-like demands on them. And that's when things start to change. But the raw cat is that ancestor that your cat has inside them.
And you say that we make a mistake when we treat cats, when we think of cats too much like dogs, when we apply dog lessons to cats. How do we go wrong?
Well, that's where we go wrong. Other than the fact that they have four legs and fur, they're completely different animals. As a matter of fact, I don't really consider cats domesticated. I mean, maybe now, at this point in their development and their sort of evolution with us, they're starting to become more, you know, doggish, for lack of a better word. But, you know, when we ask cats to show us behaviors, to show us, you know, a dependence upon us that we have bred into dogs, I mean, it's unfair to them. And it is one of the reasons why we project so much nonsense onto them, because we don't recognize the facial expressions and the communicative gestures and everything, and because of that, we judge them, we blame them, and we give them blame for all kinds of things. It's kind of crazy.
So while they might not be like dogs, we have had them in our homes for quite a while at this point. Maybe you can't really answer this, but why wasn't the domestication similar in many ways to that of a dog?
Because, you know, like I said, it's only been, I mean, that 120 years in an evolutionary sense is a blip. It's a drop of water. I mean, it's nothing. Dogs, literally, we took them out of the wild over 10,000 years ago and immediately started saying, all right, you're going to do this job for me. You're going to do all of these jobs for me, and you're going to like it. In fact, you're going to be my best friend, and you're going to do this, and you're going to wag your tail, and you're going to do all these things that I recognize so that I can get on board with who you are. And over, that's you know, I'm shortcutting it, but that's, you know, those, all of those years of breeding in those characteristics. As a matter of fact, it's really funny. There's some stuff that we bred into them that we didn't even know we were doing, like eyebrows. We bred eyebrows into dogs so that when they give us a baleful look, we know exactly what that means, right? We just didn't need to do that with cats because we didn't have that relationship. They were working members of the family. They lived on the farm. They took care of the mice, and that was it. And just now, we're completing that transition of cats in homes, in apartments, in houses, where, you know, just a century or two ago, that wasn't the case. So it takes a long time for genetics to get reprogrammed.
We're talking to Jackson Galaxy. His new book is Total, Cat Mojo, The Ultimate Guide to Life with Your Cat. And Jackson, a lot of your book and your work takes those lessons you were just talking about them and helps people apply them for what they see as troublesome or nuisance cat behaviors. We'll get into some particulars. I'm sure our listeners will have some. But talk about how you use that knowledge of the cat's nature as a tool to overcome what we see as difficulties with our cats.
Well, you know, I think one of the first things that we have to come to grips with is we took this wild animal, brought them into our homes, and then got mad at them for not peeing and pooping in a box. You know, it's one of those weird moments where we made demands that were against their nature. A cat's nature is to go around the perimeter of their entire territory and market with their pee and their poop. And for them to go in the same place every day, every time, is not horribly reasonable, you know. So one of the biggest arguments I get with my clients is when I ask them, plead with them, to add more litter boxes in their house, and they just don't want it. You know, people don't want more litter boxes. But if we start shifting our way of thinking and remembering the closeness of proximity between the raw cat and your cat, we'll start to provide more that would give them that territorial sense of security, which all cats need, that sense of ownership. So, you know, I can't count how many homes I've gone into where you just don't even know that a cat lives there. There's no trees, there's no beds, there's no litter boxes, there's no places that, you know, places that I would call signposts, where cats soak their scent into it and it gives them a sense of mojo, a sense of belonging.
And we actually had a listener email us, Leah. She says that she has a cat that pees on her couch. She thinks that her cat has separation anxiety, and she is, quote, at her wit's end. That was an email. And, of course, if you want to email us, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. So there are a couple of things there. One, which is kind of what you were talking about, that, you know, cats might be marking in different places, but also some anxiety or some irritation on the part of the owner. How do we reconcile those?
Well, and that hopefully is what the book is about. I mean, this was my chance to sort of put everything I know about these guys into one place. But beyond that, it's about empowering you, not just with the tools, but with a better sense of your relationship with them. So, for instance, if this person is saying it's separation anxiety, where is she getting that information? What has she deduced from her life with her cat and the changes that have gone on in their environment and when it started and why it started on that spot and all that? You know, it's that which is the thing that makes it impossible for me to help folks just, you know, when they write an email, but I want them to be their own best detective and to give them the tools that I would give you if I walked into your house, you know, and hopefully, you know, that's what the book provides.
Thanks a lot for that email, Leah. And Jackson, you, one thing we shouldn't do, you say you want to ban the bottle, stop people using the spray bottle to keep the cat from doing whatever behavior, climbing on the counter it's not supposed to.
Right, right. The idea is, and it's very much like, I mean, we have to start thinking about, in our relationship with our cat, what is a reasonable thing to do? You know, the example that I use in the book is that if you know, you woke up one morning and your child had taken a whole box of crayons to the walls in the house, sure, you can get upset, but you have a choice to make. Either you punish and that's it, which is not very constructive, or you say no, you can't do this, but then you provide an easel, then you provide paper, you provide a place for that creativity or whatever to have an outlet. With cats, we are telling them not to do something and not giving them an alternative. So you always want to have a yes behind the no. If you want them to not go on the countertop, sure, you could put something that's kind of sticky up there or any number of deterrents that are sold on the market and say no to the cat. But then you have to ask yourself, why did they want to go up there in the first place? What is it about that spot? A lot of the countertop thing is we keep food up there, then we say to them, no, you can't go up there where the food is. And the other thing is, because it's a very socially significant area, we should give them a yes. We should give them a perch near that location where they can get up, observe the family during socially important times, and be a part of it without just saying no. Now, the spray bottle is that ultimate expression of frustration. What I don't think folks realize is that every time you spritz that thing, number one, you're not doing anything, because unless you spritz them every single time they do that behavior, you're not accomplishing anything from a training perspective. And number two, because your hand is attached to that bottle, you are breaking down the bond between you and your cat. You're making them afraid of you, not the bottle itself. And, you know, so there's many better ways to do that. And, again, I provide, hopefully, that kind of knowledge in the book.
We're talking to Jackson Galaxy right now. He is a cat behavior expert and the host of Animal Planet's show My Cat from Hell and the more recent show Cat vs. Dog. He's talking with us about his new book, Total Cat Mojo, The Ultimate Guide to Life with Your Cat.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about cat behavior? Maybe you're trying to understand your cat, make sense of why your cat behaves the way it does, makes a particular noise or other behavior. Maybe you have a question about feeding them, training them. Maybe you've got that nuisance behavior that Jackson might be able to point you in the right direction on. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Jackson Galaxy. His new book is Total Cat Mojo, The Ultimate Guide to Life with Your Cat.
Call in with your questions and experiences at 800-642-1234. Do you see some of these common misconceptions about cats? Are there any common cat behaviors that you're still trying to make sense of? And do you want to know how to give your cat a better environment? Call or share your thoughts now at 800-642-1234. Again, that is 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Right to your calls now. Jack is with us in Eau Claire. Jack, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask, Jack?
Well, I have a cat that we've had for a couple of years, and we just recently adopted a dog, and the dog has kind of taken over the house. Our cat lives in our bedroom, and there's a baby gate, so the cat has a safe space. And I'm just wondering how we can make the cat feel more comfortable to be around the dog and out in the rest of the house as well.
Jack, thanks. Dogs and cats living together. Jackson, the subject of your new show, I think, Cat versus Dog. What do you suggest for Jack?
Well, I mean, and again, I haven't seen what's going on in his house, but from a general perspective, I think what we tend to do is, I think, and I'm not saying this from a cat biased position. I love dogs. I have dogs. That said, I think we cut dogs a little bit too much slack. And let's face it, if the dog can't do a protracted sit and stay, especially when a cat is walking across the room, and I don't care if there is a baby gate, if the dog sees the cat and just immediately goes towards, and the cat knows that they're, you know, not safe, then we've got a problem. I mean, really, it's about doubling down on your training, making sure that your dog can predictably hold still when the cat is walking across the room so that the cat doesn't immediately see the dog as a threat. And I think that's really important. And if you don't have that level of obedience, just make sure that in those first few weeks that they're meeting each other, that your dog is always on a leash. Because, again, you know, a cat is a prey animal, so they are programmed to have their head on a swivel and to be able to, you know, differentiate between friend and foe in a heartbeat. And if your dog is moving forward towards your cat always, then they're going to say foe, you know.
And we're going to go now to Sam in Janesville. Hi, Sam.
Hi. So my question is about how cats see their owner. I've heard that they see them as either a big cat or some other large animal, but not necessarily revere them as their owner. And then secondary question following that up is if you die and pass away and your cat is in the house, because it doesn't respect you as an owner, it won't just lay down by your side and pass away with you. It'll start to consume you. Have you heard about this? Is this more than just a fun fact in a bar that's not really true?
Sam, thank you so much for that call. So, Jackson, we've got two questions here. One, but they're really about the perception of humans in relation to cats. First, how do cats actually think of us?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for every single one of them. there are a lot of cats that are more attached to human than to territory. The majority are attached to the territory, with the humans being a very, very important part of that territory. And, of course, you know, all animals can bond with other animals, you know. And we've seen proof of that. It's the hottest thing on the Internet right now is, like, you know, a sheep and a duck have become best friends, you know, that kind of thing. We've seen plenty of that's a, you know, that is a given. But we are right now, that question touches on so many different stereotypes, you know. And as you can see, it's also fed through dog-colored glasses, right? Because that whole, well, he won't just lie down next to you and die with you. I don't know dogs that'll do that. I think what will happen with your dog, if they're, I mean, not to be the Grim Reaper here, but, you know, if you're in a house alone and your dog is there with you and you die, sorry, the dog's going to eat you. In about 2 or 3 days' time, when there's no food, that's what the dog's going to do. And the cat's going to do the same thing. I know it's grotesque, but that was the question.
That
you
was
know?
The question.
It's
so.
Not a matter of loyalty. It's a matter of survival, you know? So we got to just get our heads away from that, because cats don't act like Lassie, that they're not capable of expressing love. And, again, I go through a lot of different body language in the book trying to explain to you what trust looks like. So, for instance, I teach people about the concept of the slow blink, that if you do this slow blink with a cat, oftentimes, in fact, most times, that if you do it enough, they start blinking back at you. It's this amazing technique that I've used with strange cats, you know, that it's a way of establishing trust between us. Now, you take a prey animal like a cat, and you ask them to close their eyes to a potential death threat, you know, and they do. That's saying, I love you, I trust you, I know that you're not going to try to kill me. This is the raw cat speaking through yours and showing you vulnerability. And for a cat to show anyone vulnerability, that's ultimate trust, you know. So these are the things we need to start looking at, and not just the wagging tail.
Sam, thanks for that call. We're talking to Jackson Galaxy. His new book is Total Cat Mojo, The Ultimate Guide to Life with Your Cat. Back to your calls now. Tammy is on the line in Madison. Tammy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to ask the author what his thoughts were on cat fencing. My personal experience, we already had a 6-foot fence. You can do it to a wood fence or a chain link fence. It was $300, a day's worth of work. I have very happy, healthy cats that go in and outside at will through a pet door. I've never had them escape. And I just struggle to keep a cat inside you know, every day of its life. So I just kind of wanted your thoughts on that.
Well, we've actually, I mean, we've done at least one episode per season where we've offered up cat fencing as a solution to what was going on in the home. I mean, there's some great companies out there. The fencing that the caller's describing is a fence that comes up off of the top of your existing fence and comes out at about a 45-degree angle, so that when a cat goes to jump over it, oftentimes they'll just take a look up and realize they can't do it. But that part of the fence also sort of comes down almost like a dunk tank. So if they try to grab onto the top, it just dumps them back. It also serves the purpose of keeping other cats out of your yard as well, which is equally important. And I think it's an amazing solution. I think that, you know, I think that there's a mistaken perception that I say that cats should only be indoors at all times and that's the only way they should live their life. I think that the caller's right. In a perfect world, cats need to go outside. They thrive on the challenges that nature provides them. That said, if we don't provide them with cat fencing or what I call the catio, sort of a screened-in porch that they can go in, then these are cats that will live statistically half as long as an indoor-only cat. And that leaves you making a really difficult decision. So the solution is, hey, if you can do the fencing, amazing. Take your cat out for walks on a harness, amazing. Catio, amazing. Otherwise, keep them inside and make a incredibly enriched world for them, both sort of from a design perspective and a play perspective, and they'll be very happy.
Tammy, thank you so much for that call. And I do think that one of the questions that does come up a lot is that indoor versus outdoor. And, you know, as you've been looking at this, the raw versus the cat with mojo, we don't have a whole lot of time left, but how can we in the indoor world or the outdoor world make our cats the best cats that they can be?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it is. It's going to be an ongoing debate forever, you know, and especially as we further urbanize our life with cats. But, you know, it's not the most responsible thing to do in this day and age to just let your cat outside. And, you know, there's a lot of things out there that will kill them, you know, and we know that. But indoors, you know, I've written two entire books about designing a world inside your house that works for you and for your cats as well, where they get to explore the vertical world a little bit more, where they get to explore under things in a creative way, where they get to let out their little hunter in ways that just include stalking, where we have cat TV, where we put bird feeders outside the window so they can watch that way. And then it all comes down to play. And, you know, daily play, interactive play rituals with your cat, I think is the most important component to bringing out the mojo, the most important. If you have a dog, you have a leash and a collar, and you go for walks. If you have a cat, you have interactive toys where they hunt it, and you act like an idiot by running around the house and pretending to be a bird, pretending to be a worm, or whatever it is, investing into that, allowing their hunter to come out. The difference is day and night, and that, to me, is a way that we can reconcile the indoor and the outdoor.
Jackson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks, guys.
We've been talking to Jackson Galaxy. He's a cat behaviorist and host of Animal Planet's show, My Cat from Hell. Also, the new show, Cat vs. Dog. And a new show, that's the one I just mentioned, Cat vs. Dog, that just premiered. We've been talking about his new book, Total Cat Mojo, The Ultimate Guide to Life with Your Cat.
Yesterday, we asked you to share some books that you wanted to see turn into TV shows.
And your suggestions keep on coming. Here's some of what you told us on social media.
So Adam said, Terry Pratchett is one of the most prolific satire and fantasy writers ever, and his Discworld series could be incredible as a series if it's done right.
There's a lot of books in that Discworld saga. I haven't read them myself, but I guess if that's a hit, then they can just keep running
keep going for
a long
time.
Sue says, All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr, a Pulitzer Prize winner. The book has a lot to keep you guessing at what's coming next.
Chris says, any and all of the number one ladies detective agency books. They started a TV series some years ago, and unfortunately it ended after one season, which I imagine would be so hard if you're invested and you've been
all
looking
right,
for this
I've
for so long
show.
And now it's God.
It's gone. We heard from Lisa. Lisa says, this one's in the works right now, actually. A Discovery of Witches by Deborah Harkness, part of the All Souls trilogy. It will air first, Lisa says, in the UK. I can't wait until we can watch it in the US. This is years in the making. A lot of fans. We've had Deborah Harkness on the show. It's been a long time. So, talking about some of her nonfiction work, I think.
And of course, not of course, but Paul wants the Wheel of Time series by Robert Jordan. And apparently this is already in the works, it seems.
I saw some news. It's in production as of April. And again, there are a lot of very large books in that series, so it could run a long time. Keep them coming on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.